Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is December 5th, 2013. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm back in Hickory Valley after a great drive from San Francisco cross country, stops in Fresno, Burbank, Los Angeles, Palm Springs, Texas, and in the Ozarks. There's a lot percolating in this country. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving and holiday. It's always great to stop, take some time, and give thanks. We have much to be thankful for. Up on the left-hand side of the blog is a notice of our gift of Solari, give the gift of Solari. That's for subscribers. Any of you who'd like to give a complimentary two-month subscription to people in your network, please let us know at customer service. It's all described there. If you click on give the gift, it's our way of helping you stretch your Christmas budget a little bit farther and to say thanks to you. Also up is our Christmas card. Our graphic this year from Lazzardi Communications is Santa going to the stars, inspired by our conversations about the breakaway civilization and also announcements of our 2013 donations. Check them out. First to the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute in Wisconsin for helping veterans learn farming. Another to a wonderful preschool education for kids in East Palo Alto, the Creative Montessori Learning Center. And finally, Open Source Ecology for its Micro House Build program. Check those out. We'll be putting blog posts up about them as well. We love the holidays. Every week this month, we'll be having Christmas music that will be choices from the whole Solari team. So watch for some great picks for every Friday. We put it up on the top of the blog on Friday. Our theme tonight is it's nuts and bolts time. That's because it's year end. It's the time when we all think about taxes and how our portfolio did and our New Year's resolutions and what the budgets and strategic plans will be, whether it's for ourselves or our business or practice. And so I asked Patty Kemmerer, who is a wonderful CPA who I've worked with for many years. She's a member of Kemmerer Schooley Smith CPAs, to join me for a review of U.S. taxes. Now, while you still have something to do, you can do something about it before the end of the year. Patty did a great job of describing the key issues. U.S. taxes just keep getting more complex. I hope you find that conversation as useful as I did. This year's nuts and bolts is particularly a challenging time for many organizations. We'll talk in Money and Markets about the stories going of what's going on this week, but what you're seeing are enormous signs of deflation as we have both global slowdown and enormous changes in the economy because of technology and globalization. And what you're seeing is powers fighting more and more intensely over dwindling cash flows in those sectors that are shrinking. Nowhere is the nuts and bolts more painful than in the world of precious metals and commodities. Deutsche Bank announced today that it's shutting its commodities trading operations, a perfect example of how bad those markets have become. For the gold bugs, it's been a gut-wrenching year. Gold, which I started buying at about $300 to $400, went up to $1,900 in 2011 in October and is now back down to about $1,225. I had told clients I'd wanted to move principal out at 1850 and was hoping to do so in December 2011. We never made it, and so it's been a painful ride for all of us. I've done two commentaries on precious metals recently, one up on the blog this week, heads up on precious metals, and then last week, what percentage of my assets should I hold in precious metals? And between those two commentaries, essentially what I said is, my line in the sand is 1,200. I divide precious metals holdings between what's called a core position, which is that amount of coins you have to bribe the border guards with. It's for the worst case. It's insurance. It's not price sensitive. And then your investment position. And what I've said is, 1,200 is my line in the sand. I would give serious consideration to going down to your core. If you haven't already, if we break through 1,200, Mining stocks are in the worst of the throes of nuts and bolts time, because a lot of companies are going to have to shut down or shut down operations. So, and that's going to be very tough for the areas of the world and the countries that depend on those operations. Money and markets. The financial markets have everyone scratching their head. Everyone looks bad, except for the developed world equities. Bonds down, commodities down, emerging market equities down in most cases. Cash, of course, giving you no yield, enough to spark debates about should we have negative interest rates. I think it's a very bad idea. It's hard at this point to put funds in U.S. equities, which until the last few days were at all-time highs. Again, they've been down the last few days. Insider selling is quite high, but the equity flows continue in. We've seen almost $43 billion flow into equity funds over the last 2 months. It's enough to prompt Yale professor Robert Shiller, who coined the Shiller PE, to be concerned about a possible bubble and say he was, quote, most worried about the U.S. stock market. The most interesting discussion this week, I think, was in finance in Washington about the minimum wage. And I believe it was inspired by poor sales over Thanksgiving and Black Friday. I wrote a commentary called Cluster F, asterisk, asterisk, asterisk. We don't use swear words on the Salieri Report or the blog, but it's Cluster F Finances. And what I talk about is the notion of mandating a higher income to those people whose income is low, because it has essentially been stolen or destroyed by the very people who are now proposing to mandate a higher income. If you look at median household income in the United States, it's been on a downward trend since 2000. While essential household expenses have been rising, the squeeze is one we've talked about many times here on the Salieri Report. It's what I call the slow burn. And there are literally thousands of reasons for lower income, many of them related to policies of the government, including the enormous strain for the last 50 years that the black budget has put on American households. It's a combination of both the pump and dumps of the housing markets, of narcotics trafficking and other organized crime in neighborhoods, on and on and on. We certainly talked about it. And then, of course, $4 trillion missing from the U.S. government. If you have any doubt about sort of the intentionality of this, I would encourage you to watch Sir James Goldsmith's video that I've talked about so many times on the Salieri Report, and then of course my online book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. A lot of commentators will tell you that this dynamic is as a result of technology. I believe that's completely rubbish. If you look at how technology should work, it should be decentralizing if government spending regulations and enforcement had actually functioned within the boundaries of the Constitution. I would have expected both the technological wealth coming out of the black budget as well as the technological innovation more broadly would have benefited smaller players vis-a-vis larger players. So I just don't buy that story. Now, it's funny because the corporations are facing a conundrum. Let me quote from Bloomberg. Quote, the number of people on payrolls in the U.S. is still 1.5 million below the number in 2008, even after a five-year rally that has boosted the value of stocks by $14 trillion, 167% advance of the S&P 500 index during the past 57 months has been driven by reduced costs and record low borrowing costs boosting corporate profits, analysts say. Employee compensation relative to net corporate profit is at its lowest level since 1966. So essentially, we've built corporate profits by firing people. Now that the people aren't showing up to buy from retailers on Black Friday, suddenly, whoops, the president thinks we need a higher minimum wage. And of course, my comment in our commentary is, I wonder if the president will soon propose that the increased wage be mandated to go to the preferred corporate retailers. This is the problem of a centralized economy run in the Soviet method. I finally end the commentary with this paragraph. It would appear that the regulatory targeting and destruction of small farm and small business income in the heartland of America is so profitable that the lobbyists and and lawyers of the capital city can afford to buy organic. That's because the latest copy of Men's Health notes that the city of Washington is one of the highest in the country in terms of organic sales. Anyway, check out that commentary on the blog. There's this minimum wage discussion is going to get fierce. There was a headline today that we saw fast food workers picketing and lobbying for higher minimum wages. Robotics are coming, and one of the realities is the more you increase the minimum wage, the more the robots are going to go in. The fast food industry is probably in for a pretty significant revolution in terms of robotics between now and the end of the decade. Another interesting commentary, I called it Roaring Centralization, and I show Lockheed Martin, Google, and Facebook stock up against the S&P 500 treasury bonds and gold. And what you see is any corporation that's doing a good job of tightening up the central control has had a gangbuster year for the most part. Another face of the roaring centralization is the continuing war on state and local pension funds. This week, the city of Detroit, which had filed for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, received the latest opinion from the bankruptcy courts Michigan courts related to the bankruptcy filings. They ruled, in fact, that Detroit can proceed with its bankruptcy filing, which means that both unsecured creditors and pension funds are going to get rolled back, and that the Michigan Constitution protections for pension funds will not hold. Somebody wrote me today, one of the radio show hosts that I work with, and said, what does this mean? And what it means is that three decades of the lack of leadership, cooperation, and innovation, you know, across the board on all sides resulted in the obvious, which is if you have no assets, then it doesn't matter what promises you've been made or what laws are. The law is irrelevant if the assets have been disappeared, drained, or stolen. And it's a complicated story of many different things. Expect Detroit to be a prototype for radical reengineering. It's underway, and it looks like retirees are going to get pennies on the dollars. This is not a good omen for state and local pension funds and municipalities across the country. I suspect this kind of engineering to gather steam. Watch out for what's going to happen in Puerto Rico. That story is going to be much worse, and there's certainly pain ahead. So let's go through the stories on the blog. There is, as I said, a tremendous amount happening as sort of nuts and bolts time comes with year end. The Ukraine pulling out of the Euro deal is a story of great importance. It's another example of Putin's determination to return Russia to a position of power, using as much leverage as he can where he can. One of his problems is the introduction of fracking technology to Europe. Russia's position as a supplier of oil and gas is critical to its strategic position. So this really represents a deep squabble between Putin and the G7. A report this week that opium production in Afghanistan is at an all-time high is not surprising, given the squabbling back and forth between Russia and the United States. A lot of that opium is targeted into Russia. It's a profitable way to weaken and destroy your competition, as I'm sure the way the powers that be see it. The face-off between China, Japan, U.S. In the East China Sea continues. We have several pieces up on the blog about that, and we'll continue to follow it. Expect China to keep flexing its muscles. It's just launched its first aircraft carrier this week. Interestingly enough, the renminbi passed the euro in terms of global trade finance, taking a market share of 8.66%, up from only 1.89% at the beginning of the year. That's extraordinary. The euro was the second largest at the beginning of the year, was 7.87. They're down in October to 6.64%. The U.S. dollar continues to enjoy a massive market share, 81%, but it's slipping. It's down to 81% is down from 84% in January. China, as we described in the blog, has halted its IPO halt. So expect Chinese IPOs to move forward. The reform effort in China is going to be very interesting to watch if the world can ever believe that Chinese accounting and securities regulation is trustworthy as their market capitalization continues to grow. There is going to, you know, it continue to be an extraordinary increase in the amount of money flowing into those equity markets. I did a little search this week as I watched the sort of growth of what's happening in China to check how many people speak English versus Mandarin. When you have as many native speakers as they do in China, you have a great competitive advantage. Wikipedia shows a dispute because the claim is that 1.8 million people, including everyone who speaks English as a second language, that totals to 1.8, which would put it ahead of Mandarin, which is now at about 1.1 native speakers and a very negligible amount in secondary speakers. But it'll be interesting to see as the growth of the Chinese economy continues what the competition is going to be for the most spoken language around the world. That's an incredibly important aspect to the fundamental economic warfare going on. Despite the face-off East China Sea, there are still hopes for cooperation. The Wall Street Journal reports that China Mobile and Apple have finally agreed to a deal to make iPhone available to China Mobile's 700 million users. So that's going to be good for Apple if it's the case. And the Bitcoin brouhaha continues in China with China banning banks from trading Bitcoins. I want to stress again, I keep getting emails from subscribers, a very strong recommendation to only put money in Bitcoin or any of these currencies that you're prepared to lose 100%. This is a highly speculative investment. It certainly does not contribute to freedom. Anybody who says that doesn't understand what's really going on. Please assume in the worst case that there is absolutely no anonymity. So if you're trying to do things in and around tax or other authorities with Bitcoin, I just think it's suicide. The Volcker Rule implementation is coming. It's going to have an impact on proprietary trading. It's going to be interesting to see. We're going to be following it. Something really big is up in oil and gas. We had Al Gore yapping several weeks ago about how technology is going to replace fossil fuels, or renewable technologies are going to replace fossil fuels, and stock market capitalization in fossil fuels is at real risk. It was clearly the beginning of a campaign, and sure enough, what we're beginning to see is a push for colleges to have their endowments disinvest in fossil fuel companies. An article from the Washington Post up on the blog about the fossil fuel divestment movement. I'm curious to see who and what is really behind it. Things like this don't happen by an accident. So there's a real campaign going on, and it's part of what we'll be discussing next week with Jim Norman when we talk about the oil card. There's a hearing scheduled this month for the new head of the IRS. I had written a commentary about that in August. Expect when that position is filled for the targeting of the tax havens to go ahead. We have coming in a player who's typically someone Mr. Global sends in when he wants a very tough job to get done. I think I called the commentary, make way for the killers, or make way for the financial cleaners. So here it comes. Science and technology. The stories this month in science and technology are extraordinary. We have Jeff Bezos, CEO of Amazon, announcing last weekend that they're putting together a system for drones to deliver from their warehouses within a 10-mile radius. Now, this can't roll out until the commercial ban on drones ends in 2015, but expect this to be something that made the decision by Amazon to do large CIA contracts and by the Washington Post a very strategic decision. The combination of what Amazon is up to is starting to take it from being what looked to be a fairly friendly organization to something not very friendly at all. 23andMe was a genetic testing services started by the wife of one of the founders of Google. I used to describe it as terrifying. Sure enough, Scientific America is now describing it as terrifying, and the FDA has come down hard on it. Good for the FDA. Science Goes Wrong is a commentary from The Economist that's up. It's off the homepage now, but it's worth reading. A description of how much science, in fact, behind many different things upon which policymakers are depending turns out to be very wrong. It's a little chilling. And finally, a post on asteroid mining. We have major money in Silicon Valley and around the world coming together to build the capacity, the private capacity, to do mining using robotics. It almost makes you wonder if there is not a connection between what they know and what is happening to the mining stocks. So check it out. There's a lot up on the blog this week because there's a lot going on. Our hero this week is a young man named Ty Linger. He's a Christian rancher from Montana who created an organization called Heifers for South Dakota. It's kind of a cattle aid for farmers who've lost livestock in one of the worst storms ever to hit South Dakota. It's a very touching story. Our runner-up is Barbara Walters, who was overruled by the corporate headquarters when she pushed hard to have Snowden, Edward Snowden, voted the or nominated the most fascinating personality of 2013. I'm with Barbara. Good for her. It took a lot of chutzpah to push that. And finally, while we're in the hero category, I wanted to, of course, mention that it was announced today that Nelson Mandela has died at the age of 95. Ask Catherine. I wanted to start Ask Catherine with not a question we got this week, but an apology for one of my answers in recent weeks. I keep defending Bill Moyers, and I want to apologize for that, because if you look at his coverage of the Kennedy assassination, it was not only absent, but he did an interview where he interviewed a scholar about all that had gone wrong with our politics and groaning about our culture without ever addressing why or how. And to be silent on the Kennedy assassination and literally talk about the symptoms that result when those kinds of things go on and the media brings no transparency to them, it was not his best moment. A couple of comments on the Vatican Embassy. Somebody sent me a note about our coverage, my conversation with Joseph Farrell about the latest doings at the Vatican, and asked, is it possible that Francis is being coerced? I wrote back and I said, it's possible. I was just reviewing the announcements by the U.S. as to why it is now moving its embassy to the Holy See outside of Vatican City. Looks to me like arguably the world's greatest money laundering mechanism is being disassembled. Impossible to tell what's going on, just seems very important. They wrote back, agree. The move sends an extraordinary political message. Coercion could mean major league disagreement. As you have intimated, how it turns out is anyone's guess. We do indeed live in very interesting times. That is the case. I suspect the reason that the U.S. is pulling its embassy back behind the walls in Rome is that whatever the Vatican is up to, it is putting the, sort of the NSA operations within that embassy and whatever is going on in terms of, money movements behind the protection of diplomatic immunity. That's a whole mechanism that they can't afford transparency on. So it looks to me like the ducking of transparency. Another question, I got this question from my sister and wondered if we might cover it on the Soleri Report. And the question is, in reading about the potential threat of forced purchases of government bonds, In pension funds, do you think that means all company 401ks and personal IRA accounts across the board, or would it strictly be company 401k plans? There's been some recent articles on the fear of basically sort of targeted investment by 401ks that have been very sort of choppy and misleading. I'd be careful. We put up a week ago a link to the latest CBO proposals for balancing the budget, 100 plus ideas. I would strongly recommend, if you want to see what's in the wind, you check that out. The goal on 401ks and IRAs is to increase the total funds available. If anything, the political push right now is to get more funds going into equities than bonds. You know, you keep seeing this proposal floating around to get Social Security set up so that you can basically invest the money in the stock market. I'm not as worried at this point about forced purchases of treasuries as opposed to equity. I'm much more worried about mandating that small business has to do 401ks and that essentially bankrupting small business by forcing them to set aside an even greater percentage of their profits to finance large corporations. If they do such a thing, I can't tell you how important it is that small businesses organize and start to do community venture funds and other things that allow small business capital within a community to be reinvested, or at least a portion be reinvested in the businesses and equity opportunities in those communities. Another question, you mentioned earlier this week that if the price of gold goes below $1,200 an ounce, that you recommend selling everything except core holdings. What do you believe now represents better alternatives than gold in today's economy? Everybody has to make up their own mind on this topic, but I can tell you what I'm doing personally. I have always believed that people are a better investment than gold, and if you look at my personal investments, they generally track that. First and foremost, I help a lot of people out. I make a lot of donations off and on throughout the years. In my own business, I try and flow a lot of money to independent individuals who do things from making cartoons to helping us with our website or advising me on technology. So I would much rather create jobs by building my own business, or I invest occasionally in other private businesses. And then finally, great companies. If you look at what I've been doing personally, as I identify, and I'm very much a great leadership and great management team, where I see great management and leadership aligned with what I consider to be the long-term trends, I consider those to be very good opportunities. If and when gold bottoms, I expect it's going to go back to the category of being a very good investment. And there are times in the market when stepping aside and sitting in cash for a period of time while things shake out is not a bad idea. It's one of the things that I did a lot of, or advised a lot, in 2008, and it turned out to be a very good strategy. We called it the big chicken, and sometimes it can hurt to be a chicken. Finally, what is the relationship between the powers that be and the mainstream media? Do the powers that be control all the major stories that get released or buried within the media? Essentially, yes, but there's still a fair amount that percolates out. And what we now see is tremendous factionalism with different factions using transparency through the major media to squabble. As the alternative media has grown up, the major media is being forced to win back market share, and you'll see a variety of us in the major media, in the internet media, do things and have it picked up. I can't tell you how much the Solari Report gets picked up and taken. We often have market research firms sign up, and they sign up and listen, and shortly thereafter, you're hearing literally sometimes even the same sentence and paragraph coming out of the mouth of somebody on the major media. It's always fascinating to watch. A question about CPAs. Patty and I had recommended that you have a CPA do your taxes. And somebody who's a sophisticated financial professional wrote in and said, well, I'm doing my own. Should I think about changing? Somebody who's a pretty knowledgeable financial professional is probably the exception to the rule. But even in that case, you might want a CPA. if you're doing 99% of the work, you ought to be able to get it low cost. But I would say that it's an added layer of protection. The rules are getting so complicated, and enforcement is getting very, very troublesome. So I think it makes it, if you have a qualified CPA who is checking everything you're putting in, I think it's another layer of protection. I think it's extremely important to be picky and careful and make sure you're finding somebody who's extremely ethical. Let's go to the movies. I wanted to revisit a favorite, which we've mentioned on the Salieri Report in Let's Go to the Movies before, and that's The Name of the Rose. Sean Connery plays a traveling monk, and in this wonderful mystery taking place during the events of the Inquisition. And it's a movie that really highlights what happens to enterprises who go about hoarding knowledge and the fights and sort of powers that be, squabbles that can erupt in the face of that. I love the movie for many reasons. One is sometimes I do feel a little bit like Sean Connery traveling from place to place, trying to seek out the civilized in a world that's becoming increasingly uncivilized. And so when I travel, sometimes I'll think of different scenes from The Name of the Rose. But given the events of what's happening with the Vatican's move to greater transparency, I think it's a very appropriate movie to watch, because if you look at who's sitting on probably the richest archives and library and secret knowledge in the world, it's certainly the Vatican. So the idea of the Vatican moving to greater transparency could certainly disturb more than a few people. So check it out. It's a wonderful movie if you haven't seen it. Okay, that's it for this week. In closing, coming up next week, we have Jim Norman back with the Oil Card, one of my favorite guests. And there's so much going on in the world of energy, both fossil fuels and renewables, and of course, the discussion about breakthrough energy. So I'm really looking forward to that. Make sure to get your questions in. We already have several questions for Jim that I didn't address today. We'll hold off and wait until he's back. And then part of Nuts and Bolts time and Coming Clean, December 19th, Dr. Laura Thompson is going to join me to talk about winter wellness. What are the things you can do now to make sure you're strong, you don't come down with those flus, and what to do if you do. And then finally, December 26th, we'll have John Rappaport on the report the day after Christmas. So until next week with Jim Norman, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a real privilege. I'm inviting, as I described in my blog post, somebody to the Salieri Report who I believe fits the description of a great accountant. And as you know, it's hard to find, and if you do, treasure them forever. Patty Kemmerer is a member of Kemmerer Schooley Smith, CPAs in Northern Virginia. She has a wealth of experience working with both businesses, individuals, not-for-profits. I first met her when I was at Hamilton Securities, so I can tell you she also has a lot of experience dealing with all the complexities of government and government contractors and the issues that they deal with. She's a member of many accounting societies, but one of the things I most appreciate about Patty is she's very experienced, very grounded, very practical, and yet can deal with all the complexity that is involved when you deal with all these different kinds of issues. And so I asked Patty to join us to discuss for those who file U.S. taxes, both individual and small business issues that are the most important to focus on in 2013. We're coming into 2014, so what are the What are the actions we can take before the end of the year or need to take at the beginning of the year to make sure we're on top of our taxes? So, Patty, it's holiday season. Thank you for taking time out of what I know is a very busy schedule to join us on the Solari Report.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, well, top of our list, of course, is the Affordable Health Care Act, which I must tell you, we had a rule in Washington, which was, you know, never do something too complicated that the average person is going to have to deal with. Of course, every time I try and understand the Affordable Health Care Act, I think, they broke the rule. So take us through the Affordable Health Care Act. We're now in a period when it applies. So what does it mean to our taxes? What do we need to know about the Affordable Health Care Act?
Well, as you know, all individuals that are required to have that minimum essential coverage by March 31st, 2014, or they have to be exempt in order to avoid the shared responsibility payment, which is being commonly addressed as the penalty for not having it, the coverage
right.
by March 14th. And the shared responsibility payment and the Act itself is effective January 1st, 2014. It applies to all individuals of all ages, including children. So adults or a married couple who claim an individual as a dependent is responsible to make the payment for the dependent who doesn't have coverage. So parents need to be aware that it's not just them, it's also their children that have to be covered, or they have to pay the shared responsibility payment penalty with their tax return when they file their 2014 taxes in 2015. There are some exemptions for people to be excluded from this. And just to go over a few of the more common ones, if a person does not have a filing requirement, they are not required to pay the shared responsibility payment. That would be someone whose income is below the minimum threshold for filing a tax return. So if you don't have to file a tax return because you're below that threshold, you're not required to pay the shared responsibility payment if you don't have coverage. Also, if you have a short coverage gap, being without coverage for less than 3 consecutive months during the year, then you also don't have to pay the penalty. If there's a hardship, the health insurance marketplace has determined conclusively that a person has a hardship that makes them unable to obtain coverage, they're also excluded from paying the penalty. In addition, if a person is not lawfully present in the United States, they are also exempt from paying the penalty.
Is lawfully present, do you know what the time period is on that?
I do not know what the time period is. I presume
okay.
that it's during the calendar year. Or at the end of the calendar year, if you're not lawfully
right.
present. You know, you're still required to file tax returns in theory,
right.
but because you would probably meet the substantial presence test, that is, if you're in the country, even on, illegally, for more than 183 days of the year and you earn money here, you're supposed to file a tax return. But if you're here unlawfully, you're not required to pay this penalty if you don't have health insurance coverage
right.
by the deadline. Right. Also, just to let people know, the shared responsibility payment penalty is the greater of 1% of yearly household income, or $95 per person, $47.50 for a child under 18 for 2014. And the maximum household penalty for 2014 is $285. So you hear many people talking about, well, they'll just pay the penalty. It's a fairly low penalty in 2014, but it will go up to 2% of income and $325 per person in 2015. And 2.5% of income, or $695 per person for 2016. After that, it will be adjusted for inflation. So while it's fairly low penalty in 2014, as you can see, it will go up and will become more substantial as time goes on.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because I know people who, you know, they live with family, and so the household income is defined in a way that catches a lot of income which is not available to them. And I've literally had people tell me they're thinking of getting divorced just because they can't afford to pay the penalty.
I've heard that as well.
Right.
But, you know, household income is household income. So getting
right.
divorced, if you're still going to live together, I'm not sure that that will avoid the issue.
Okay.
So that would be very sad.
Penalties are sad. Okay, so now when the White House has delayed the application to small business or to business for a year, is that correct?
That is correct. That just recently came about.
But they, you know, the debate when there was the squabble at the beginning or, you know, recently was over whether or not they would delay individuals, and they haven't. This still applies.
This does still apply. This
okay.
has not been delayed for individuals.
Okay. Okay. So let's keep going on the healthcare issues.
Okay. Also, there is a premium tax credit that is available for lower income individuals that can assist with lowering the premiums. They have to buy the health insurance through the marketplace. They have to be ineligible for coverage through an employer or a government plan. They have to be, like I said, within these lower income limits. If they're married, they have to file a joint return, and they cannot be a dependent of another person. So if a person is eligible for this premium tax credit, they have two choices of what to do with it. They can take sort of an advance on it now and have the credit paid directly to the insurance company to lower their out-of-pocket cost on a monthly basis, or can get it later when they file their tax return.
Okay.
So those are two choices for the premium credit. Also, as you know, there were some surprises in the tax, in this law, related to an additional Medicare tax of 0.9% for taxpayers who have earnings over applicable thresholds in 2014.
Now that's 200,000 on earned income, or it includes investment income?
It's on earnings of 200,000 or more for a single filer, or 250,000 for married filing joint. And that is joint income. So a married couple is much more likely to reach the threshold faster than perhaps a single individual would be.
Right.
Now, once a person reaches $200,000 in earned income, their employer is supposed to withhold the additional 0.9% of tax that they're required to pay. And this is only a tax on the employee. The employer does not have to match that 0.9% for that for those wages above $200,000 like they do for the other wages that they pay the Medicare tax matching on.
Right.
The 2.9% Medicare tax. It's 1.45% for the individual earner and 1.45% for the employer. The employer continues just to pay the 1.45%. They don't have to pay the additional 0.9. If the employer
right.
doesn't withhold it, ultimately the employee is going to be liable to pay it with their tax return. And in theory, the employer could be fined for not withholding it when they're
okay.
supposed to.
Okay. Now the investment tax is on top of this one.
Right. It's 3.8%. It applies to taxpayers who have earnings above those same thresholds, $200,000 for a single filer and $250,000 for married filing joint return.
Now, okay, so let me get this. If I have, let's say I have $200,000 of earned income, I have $100,000 of capital gains, and $100,000 of dividend and interest income in a given year.
Right.
Is the 3.8 is on the dividend and interest. It's going to be across the board since I already have $200,000 of earned income.
Correct.
And is it going to be 3.8 on capital gains as well?
It will. It's going to be on it's going to be on income from interest, dividends, annuities, royalties, and rents. So people with rent, yes, on rent as well. It's also going to be on income that passes through from a trade or business if the person is passive in that business. That is to say that they're simply an investor in a small business or in a REIT or whatever they're invested in, and they're not an active participant in the day-to-day activities. They're considered to be a passive investor. It's an investment for them, not a business. And so those funds coming through from K-1s, from partnerships and S-corporations, would also be hit with this 3.8%.
So if you're above $200,000, basically your capital gains rates change to 18.8%.
Well, yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
It's actually could be higher than that if you're up in the 20% capital gains rate, and
right.
then you add this on top of it, so it becomes 23.8%. Also, one thing that a lot of people probably are not aware of, that if someone is selling their principal residence and they have more than $250,000 in gain if they're single, or $500,000 in gain if they're married filing joint, the amount above those two thresholds is taxable for capital gains tax and will be subject to this 3.8% if they're over the earned income thresholds.
Even if it's their primary residence?
Even if it's their primary residence.
Wow, so that's a very significant hit.
Yes, it could be.
Yes, it could be. Okay.
Now,
so
the type of income that is excluded from the 3.8% net investment income tax are things like non-taxable income, municipal bond interest, for example, would not be included for this. Social Security benefits and alimony are excluded. Retirement plan distributions are excluded. And any income that's subject to self-employment Medicare tax would be excluded. For example, a self-employed person with a Schedule C.
Okay. Well, let's turn to health. I call them health savings accounts. Let's walk through sort of what the new limit is. But also, I'd be very interested to hear if you think what's happening is going to make sort of increase interest in health savings accounts.
Right. There is a new limit on the health savings account of $2,500 is the most that an employee can request for a salary reduction as a contribution to the flexible spending arrangement. Are we talking the health savings, the HSA?
Right.
Okay, so the HSA.
Is health flexible spending arrangements the same thing as an HSA?
It is not.
It's not. Okay, sorry.
That's okay. The flexible spending arrangement is a deduction from taxable income right off the top. They can have their employer withhold certain amounts that can then be spent later for health purposes, for medical reasons, daycare and the like. So that's a flexible spending arrangement. It's also called a Section 125 plan,
okay,
where people can put the money aside for use later. The limit on that is now $2,500 that can be requested to be set aside from a paycheck to pay for future medical expenses.
And can't that be used to pay for your health care plan or insurance?
It can.
It can, right.
It can, yes. But do you want to talk HSAs?
If you're ready to. Solari keeps playing with starting an HSA, so.
Yeah. Yes, for HSA, you can deduct the contributions that you make to the account. And the earnings on those are tax deferred until they're withdrawn, much like an IRA.
Right.
If they're withdrawn for medical purposes, they are withdrawn tax free.
So if the employee takes the money out of the HSA to use it to buy health care insurance, at that point, it's not taxable to the employee, so it's tax free.
Well, you have to have a high deductible health plan in place,
okay,
for the HSA to have an HSA.
Okay.
And you can't be enrolled in Medicare.
Okay.
So in 2013 and 2014, the minimum deductible for a high deductible health plan has to be at least $1,250 for a single coverage,
okay,
and $2,500 for a family coverage.
Okay.
Now, if funds are not used for medical purposes, once you turn 65, you can withdraw the money out to use for any purpose, and it's taxed just like an IRA.
Okay, but there's no penalty for withdrawal.
Right.
Okay.
After age 65.
Okay, so... So tell us, what can we do to what are the steps now? It's we're going to play this on December 5th. What can we do now before the end of the year to ease our tax burden for 13 and 14?
Well, before we jump there, let me just back up one second, if you don't mind, and
please,
just mention that the Schedule A deduction, or the Schedule A medical deduction, now has to exceed 10% of your adjusted gross income. It has been 7.5%. This was part of the Affordable Care Act as well.
Okay.
So that threshold is now increased to 10%. So your medical expenses have to exceed 10% of your adjusted gross income in order for you to take any deduction for medical expenses. For people who are 65 and older, the 7.5% remains in place through 2016. But if you're under 65, it has jumped, actually for 2013, it has jumped to 10%.
Okay.
So just so people are aware of that as well. Now, back to your question, which was, what can we do at this point in time? If someone thinks that if they're not at that $200,000, $250,000 threshold yet in 2013 to trigger this 0.9% and the 3.8% additional taxes, but they feel like maybe in 2014 they might push over those limits, one thing that they might be able to do is pull some of those earnings for 2014, if possible, into 2013 to try to avoid triggering those two additional
taxes. So, for
taxes.
Example, if you have gains, you can take them.
Exactly. If you have gains, you can take them. If you think it's going to push you over for 2014, but you can take some of them in 2013 and still not push over the limit, and perhaps stay under the limit for 2014 as well. That's one thing that would be a good idea to take a look at.
Okay.
Also, there are things that you can do to accelerate deductions into 2013 if you feel like you're getting close to that limit in 2013 and you want to reduce your income. You can pay your fourth quarter state estimated tax installments in December instead of January, because you can get the deduction for them in 2013 if you just pay them a couple of weeks early in December.
Right.
You could pay your entire property tax bill, including installments due in 2014 by the end of the year, and also pull that into your deductions for 2013.
Okay.
You can try to bunch your threshold expenses. When I say threshold expenses, I mean things like medical expenses that have to exceed that 10% threshold. And there's also miscellaneous itemized deductions that have to exceed 2% of your adjusted gross income before you can take any deduction. And those would be things like investment expenses, job hunting expenses, home office deductions for persons who are employees of a company but who work at home for the convenience of their employer. Things like anything that you can pull into 2013 to help reduce the 2013 income. Also, you could pay 2014 tuition for if you have a college student. You could pay the 2014 tuition in 2013 and perhaps get a deduction or credit for that. In addition, there are some non-business energy credits that you might be able to take for 2013. The credit is 10% of the cost of certain energy-saving property that you add to your main home. It includes qualified insulation, windows, doors, roofs, and biomass stoves. It has to be your on your main home, the existing main home in the United States. A newly constructed home or a rental does not qualify for these credits. There's a maximum lifetime limit of $500 on the credits. And when I say it's a credit, I mean it's a dollar-for-dollar credit. That means for each dollar of credit, you reduce $1 of tax liability for these
particular
credits.
So if I spend $500 on tighter doors that qualify,
yes, you
then
get
I get
10%.
Oh, I get 10%.
You get 10%.
So
yes.
I get $50.
Right, and that would be a $50 reduction in your tax bill.
Now, those are extended through 2013. Will they apply in 2014?
I believe that one is going away, actually, for 2014.
So it's use it or lose it.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
And when I said, and you can't just contract for these items if you're going to get new windows installed, for example. The windows have to be installed by December 31st.
Okay. So the home improvement guys are going to be very busy before the end of the year.
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, if you want to get new windows, probably now is the time to call. By the way, speaking of windows, only $200 of the $500 can go towards windows. That's the maximum for window credit.
If you look at how expensive windows are, I'm not sure it's going to go far, but
I agree. But, you know,
every little bit counts, yes.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about gifting.
Okay. Well, one of the things you can do is do some charitable gifting. You know, there's been a law over the last few years, which also is going to expire at the end of this year, where you can transfer directly up to $100,000 from your IRA to a charitable organization and get a deduction for it. That is expiring.
Okay.
At the end of this year. That has been in place for several years.
Okay.
But this is the last year to do that. Also,
so if,
for those
and,
of us...
And so someone could, for example, if they wanted to donate to their church, they could shift $10,000 out of an IRA to the church and then take a $10,000 deduction on their
on their taxes.
Schedule A, right. They do have to claim the $10,000 distribution as well, so it's kind of a wash, but at least you don't have to pay the tax on the distribution.
Okay, so basically what it does is it covers the deduction offsets the tax you'd have to pay on the distribution.
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, you can donate cash as well as property to a qualified charity. And generally, when you donate property, you can claim the fair market value of that property as a deduction. Contributions of appreciated property, like stock, for example, provide an additional benefit in that if you donate appreciated stock to a charity, you can write off the value of that stock and avoid paying capital gains tax.
Right.
So that's an added benefit of donating appreciated investment property. You can also donate services to charity, of course, but the value of your service to the charity is not deductible. Only your out-of-pocket expenses are. And I see this I've seen this quite a bit over my more than 25 years of experience in this area. Small business people donate services, graphic design, whatever they're doing to a charity, and they want to write off the value of that, what they would have charged a customer to perform those services. And unfortunately, you're not allowed to do that.
Okay.
So only your out-of-pocket costs are deductible. That would include some charity-related travel expenses and some other out-of-pocket expenses. You must have a written record to take a deduction. It doesn't necessarily, if it's under $250, you don't absolutely have to have a receipt from the charity if you can show some other way that you made the donation, for example, a canceled check.
Okay.
If we've made a
donation of $250 to 501c3, do we need to get a letter back saying, that we've made this donation and it does not include, payment for goods or services?
Yes.
So we need a letter. Okay.
Yeah, some kind of a receipt, a letter.
Okay. And, okay. So keep going.
Okay. So that's a current deduction on your current year taxes for charitable donations. Now, another thing we probably need to touch on, which is not a current year deduction, but something people do need to think about, is giving, year-end giving to reduce potential estate tax in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Federal gift and estate tax exemptions are currently set at $5.25 million. So that means the first $5.25 million of a value of a person's estate is exempt from tax under current law. That's going to increase to $5.34 million in 2014. Also, the maximum estate tax is now capped at 40%. People can give gifts to other people of up to $14,000 per year without having to file a gift tax return. And most people don't realize also that the gift tax return is filed by the person who gives the gift, not the person who receives the gift. So that's something to keep in mind. A couple can give a joint gift to a third person of up to $28,000. That would be $14,000 coming from each of them to the third person. They do, of course, have to agree to gift in order to take the exemption of up to $28,000 for a gift to a third person. So that's one way people gift, especially around holiday time, gift to their relatives and friends to be generous, of course, to these folks, but also to try to reduce the value of their estate for future estate tax planning purposes.
Okay.
And then, of course, the gift tax return is due. If you do give a gift that exceeds the $14,000, you do have to file a gift tax return, and it's due on the same date as your regular tax return.
Okay, retirement plan contributions. This one is a big one for our subscribers because I think up there, you know, there's a tremendous amount of concern that the provisions will change over time. So there's always interest in, for example, in should I move to a Roth? So tell us about retirement plan contributions for 2013.
Right. If you own a business, you should consider setting up a retirement plan if you don't already have one. You can set up the plan by the end of the year, or even you can set up a SEP plan, a Simplified Employee Pension Plan, even early next year. Make the contribution by the due date of your tax return, including extensions. So potentially you could push it all the way to October 15th of 2014 and get the deduction on your 2013 tax return. So that's a really good way to help reduce your tax liability and set some money aside for yourself for the future. If you don't plan for your retirement, nobody else will.
Right. Now Roth conversions. It's still possible to convert from a simple IRA to a Roth?
It is. You do have to pay the tax on it at the time of conversion, but then that money is considered after-tax dollars in the Roth, so when you draw it out later, you won't pay tax on it later.
Right. So your fear is if your taxes are going to increase or the rates are going to increase in the future, that's the benefit of accelerating the tax into this year.
Exactly.
Right.
So if you are an employee and your employer has a 401k plan, if at all possible, you should try to maximize your contributions to that for 2013, time's running out. So you would have to put in a big chunk at this point, perhaps, to get to the maximum contribution, which is $17,500 for a person under the age of 50. And if you're over 50, you could add a $5,500 catch-up contribution as well.
Okay.
If there are no retirement plans, if you're an employee, you don't have, your employer doesn't offer one, you can make a deductible contribution of up to $5,500 to a traditional IRA and deduct it. If you are under 50, and an additional $1,000 or $6,500 total if you're 50 or over.
Okay. Okay, and more on SHA? Did we want to mention that?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, I think we pretty much covered that earlier.
Okay.
You can deduct those contributions to the account. So if you need some more deductions this year, you may want to consider an HSA. You do have to make the contribution to it this year, and you have to have that high deductible health plan in place.
Now, can an individual start an HSA, or do you need an employer?
You do not need an employer. An individual.
So an individual can do it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Section 179.
Section 179. In 2013, a business can elect to expense the entire cost of most new equipment, up to $500,000. For the first $2 million of property placed in service by December 31. So it's much like the windows and doors, it has to be in place by December 31st.
Now, does this apply for all computer and
equipment
and office equipment?
It sure does.
Wow.
Yes.
So you can write off 100%.
100% of it, up to $500,000.
Okay.
Now, that provision was expanded after 9/11 to try to stimulate the economy. That provision is, the expanded provision is expiring at the end of this year. In 2014, that deduction limit is reduced from $500,000 down to $25,000 on the first $200,000 of equipment purchased. So you can see there's a precipitous drop after 2013. So right. If any of your listeners were considering investing in large equipment, they may want to pull that into 2013 and go ahead and buy it now rather than waiting till January or February to do it.
Okay.
Now, it has to be qualified property, and qualified property is placed in service during the tax year and used predominantly in your trade or business. That means it has to be more than 50% business use. We see this, you know, with business equipment such as computers and office equipment, generally that's 100% business use. The real issue is generally vehicles. Vehicles are not always 100% business use, and so you have to make sure that if it's more than 50% in order to take any kind of a Section 179 deduction on a vehicle. Also, vehicles have real stringent limits on Section 179 deductions, Section 179 deductions. And you want to discuss that with your tax preparer. SUVs get a higher deduction than luxury autos. Luxury mm-hmm. autos are autos that generally exceed $15,300 in cost. So that's pretty much just about any vehicle that you
right.
would want to buy.
Okay.
So that is one thing to talk to your tax preparer about if you're thinking about buying new vehicles before the end of the year, because you're not going to get as much bang for your buck on a vehicle necessarily as you would other business equipment.
Okay. Okay, so CAP, let's see, how to increase basis in S-Corp. A lot of subscribers do have S-Corp, so this is of great interest.
Yeah, a lot of people, it's very hard for most business owners to get their head wrapped around what their basis in their S-corporation really is. Their basis is basically what their investment in their corporation. And if the corporation has losses, that reduces their basis. You can only deduct losses up to the amount of your basis, and that's something that your tax professional should be keeping track of on a year-to-year basis to determine what that number is. If your losses exceed your basis, you can't deduct the total amount of that loss currently unless you do something to increase your basis. If you have a loss in your business, most likely your business could use some cash. So you could either loan money to your company or make a capital contribution to your company. Either one of those things will increase your basis in the company so that you can deduct more of the current year loss. Of course, the risk is that putting more money into your company makes more of your personal funds at risk. And you need to really consider before doing that whether or not the fact that your company has a loss this year is indicative of trouble ahead.
Right.
If you feel like there is, you know, choppy waters ahead for your company, you may not want to put more money into it at the risk of losing the additional funds as well. So you do need to sit with your advisor and discuss whether or not this makes good fiscal sense for you, not just from a tax perspective, but from a long-term investment perspective.
So now, if you can't write off the losses this year, can you roll them over? So
you
they
can
carry
them. You can carry them over.
Okay.
You certainly can. So they're okay. not They don't disappear. They just get deferred to a year when you have a profit to take the losses against.
Okay. Okay. And, okay, so let's now go over expiring provisions. You said that there are 52 provisions set to expire. We're not going to go through all 52.
No, not at all. Let's just kind of hit the highlights. So, as you may recall, people who have had trouble in this economy with making their mortgage payments were allowed an exclusion for a discharge of their qualified principal residence indebtedness of up to $2 million if they lost their home, for example.
So let me explain what that means. What that means is if you lost your home or you were in a foreclosure and your mortgage was written off, that
right.
normally would have been a write-off of indebtedness becomes a taxable event, and that's income to you. And so what we're saying is up to $2 million, that was, you basically had a get-out-of-jail-free card on that. That got relieved. So what we're saying is that when traditionally, if I had a mortgage on a home, and this applied to other indebtedness, not just mortgages, but let's say we're just talking about a home, and the home was foreclosed on and the mortgage written off, that would be a taxable event. That would be considered income to me, that the debt was written off. And what was provided by the federal government was relief for a certain period so that when that debt was written off, it wasn't considered a taxable event. And I didn't have to pay tax on a write down of indebtedness. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay.
Forgiveness of debt has normally been a taxable event, but this law did exclude people who were in this situation as long as the debt was qualified principal residence debt. That is to say that it had to be your principal residence, and it had to be debt that you used to purchase or improve your home. Some people have gotten caught with home equity debt that was not considered qualified principal residence debt. But in any case, that provision expires at the end of this year.
Okay.
So that is no longer going to be available.
Okay. Well, I don't see how anybody can accelerate that into 2013.
No.
But
no,
clearly that's a, you know, if you need that, if you're in that situation, that's an unbelievably important thing to have.
But the other thing is there's also been a provision that will still exist, that if you are insolvent at the time of the debt discharge, then you also don't have to pay tax on it. So, as we go into 2014, if someone finds themselves in this situation and can show that they were insolvent at the time of the discharge of the debt, they still will not have to pay tax on the income from that discharge of debt.
Okay, now there's... Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to say a couple. I was going to touch on a couple of others. One is the $250 deduction for expenses of school teachers. That's been around for several years now, and you know, school teachers are always dipping into their pockets to pay for things for their classrooms that the school system doesn't cover for them, and they've been allowed to claim up to $250 deduction for that on the front of their tax returns. That's another expiring provision. Those expenses will now go on to Schedule A as a miscellaneous itemized deduction subject to 2% of your adjusted gross income as unreimbursed employee business expense.
Okay, were there any others you wanted to mention?
The deduction for qualified higher education expenses is going to go away. The credit will still be there. There was an option where you could deduct the expenses on the front of your return or take a credit on page 2. The deduction piece for the front of the return is expiring.
Okay.
So that will no longer be there.
Okay, and people can find a list of those on the IRS website?
It is not. It is actually it's www.irs.gov jct.gov is where you can go to look for that.
Okay. Now,
and there's a whole list of them.
To deal with this complexity, the filing season for 2014 has been delayed?
It has been delayed, and what that means is the IRS will not be able to process tax returns for 2013 at the date that they had originally anticipated, which was January 21st, was when they were going to start processing. Because of the government shutdown in October of 16 days, which was their prime time for testing their systems and updating their software, they're going to have to postpone the date when they will start processing returns by up to 2 weeks. It will be they will not be able to start processing any earlier than January 28th, and it could be as late as February 4th. They're supposed to come out this month with a definite date of when they will start processing, but they have not yet made that announcement.
So what we're saying is our filing deadlines haven't changed, but their ability to generate a refund is slowed down.
Yes, exactly. A lot of people like to file their tax returns immediately in January so that they can get their refunds, obviously. The processing date has been pushed back, so you won't be able to get your refund as early in the year as you normally would.
Okay, well, there were a couple of what I called red flags that I also wanted to touch on. A lot of our subscribers have foreign accounts, and because of that, file FBAR reforms or what's called PIFIC filings. And the one thing I just wanted to underscore is if you have foreign accounts, it's absolutely imperative that they be fully disclosed. And if you're subject to an FBAR or any of these other forms, that you do it. Because, you know, what I find is foreign accounts, not properly disclosing your foreign accounts can really cause some, trouble. So in terms of keeping records or making sure you or your CPA file those forms, you want to make sure you do it. So
right, and those forms are due by June 30th of the year, by the way.
Right, the FBAR. But there's now in the regular filings, there's disclosure as well. So
that's correct.
Right.
At the bottom of Schedule B, you have to state whether or not you have any interest in foreign bank accounts.
Now, the other thing was, I know we mentioned charitable deductions, but to me, this is another red flag, is making sure you have proper documentation for all your deductions, because I do think it's an area that has increased focus. Are there any others, Patty, that you think are important?
As far as red flags?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can tell you this, that if, depending on your income, the amount of your income may be more likely to trigger an audit. For example, people under $200,000 of income on their tax return, their audit chances are about 1.03%. People with incomes of over $200,000 have an audit rate of approximately 3.7%, or one out of every 27 returns are audited. And people who report more than $1 million in income have a 1 in 8 chance of being audited, just because of the level of income that you're reporting.
Right.
You also have to be very careful to report everything that you receive a 1099 for, because the IRS receives copies of all W-2s and 1099s, and they do have an automated matching program. So if you haven't reported something on your return that was reported to the IRS, you're much more likely to get audited on your return.
Now, let's say I file my taxes and then realize that I forgot to report something. I can always amend, right?
That's correct. You can file a Form 1040X form to report that additional income and pay the tax on it. The IRS has up to 3 years to audit you, so sometimes people don't hear from the IRS for 3 years after they file the return. and can't remember what they did or didn't do at that point in time, or
right.
where their papers got off to. You know, so make sure that you keep your support for all your tax deductions and income for a minimum of 3 years.
And what would you say would be advisable? 5 years?
Generally, I'd say 5 to 7 years.
Okay.
If the IRS suspects fraud, if you've missed a big income item, if you've missed reporting it, and the IRS suspects that, you know, suspects fraud, there is no limit.
Right.
They can come back to you without limit. So I generally tell people to keep things for at least 7 years.
Okay. Okay. Well, there are two sort of drumbeats I constantly hammer on with subscribers and with clients, and that is, you know, if you want to be impeccable about records, you want to keep a record of everything. And the other prejudice I have, which, you know, is, you know, please don't do your taxes yourself. If there's any way you can get an accountant, a good accountant to do them, I think it's really, you know, we're now talking about a level of complexity that is extraordinary. And unless you are very good at this kind of stuff and really want to take the time, I think you just need somebody who's in the thin and thick of it. So I'll since I'm not the CPA here, I'll bang that drum. And I think it's very important that you tell them you keep good records and you tell them everything, you're fully disclosed. And then if a mistake happens, you know, mistakes happen in complex systems, but I think then if you've made best efforts to be fully compliant, you don't run into trouble. I'm continually amazed running into clients who continue to, or subscribers who continue to think that there's such a thing as privacy in this financial system. And although I would say that the Mr. Snowden has done a lot to persuade everyone that that privacy is not what they thought it was. So I just think it's very, very important to be as impeccable as possible. And if you are, then you sleep at night. I think it's, you know, it's a great investment to be impeccable on all this stuff, and then you don't have to worry.
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
Okay. One other thing you mentioned, which I just wanted to touch on, was telephone scams, because I hear more and more reports of this. Hasn't happened to me personally, and I just thought maybe we should say a few things about it, because if you look at what's going on in the internet or phones, the scamsters are clearly out.
They are, and they're very sophisticated as well.
Yeah.
They know more about you than you really think that they do. And what they're doing is it's a telephone scam. They call you and they say that you owe money to the IRS and that it must be paid promptly, either through a preloaded debit card or a wire transfer. And if the victim refuses to cooperate, they threaten them with arrest, deportation, or suspension of a business or driver's license. Some things you need to know is that the IRS never asks for credit card numbers over the phone. It never requests prepaid debit cards or wire transfers. They don't ask for PINs, passwords, or any other similar confidential access information for credit card, bank, or other financial account. And generally, the first contact with a taxpayer on an IRS tax issue is most likely to occur via regular snail mail, not email. There are a lot of emails also that are coming out that appear to be from the IRS. Do not open any attachments if you receive an email from the IRS that appears to be from the IRS. And you can forward the email if you get it to phishing@irs.gov, and that is phishing@irs.gov. So if you receive an email, please send it there. Now back to the telephone scam.
Uh-huh.
They use fake names and IRS badge numbers, so they sound very official. They may be able to recite the last four digits of your social. So generally you're going to think, oh my, they must be really legitimate. They know my social. Not true. They may know it, but they're still not legit. They can actually spoof the IRS toll-free number on your caller ID to make it appear that the IRS is the one that's calling. And after they call you, they may follow up with an email.
Right. One of the things I've discovered, because I had to do this a lot, sort of over the last 15 years, if you hang up and call the IRS, the IRS, in my experience, has very excellent customer service. Now, on a busy day, it may take a while to get through, but you can usually get through, and you can get through to somebody who's competent and can handle your request. And so, if you have any doubts, you can always hang up and just call the IRS.
Right. So if you get one of the calls and you know you owe taxes or you think you might, you should call their 800 number, which is 800-829-1040.
Okay.
On the other hand, if they call and you know you don't owe any tax, they recommend that you call the Treasury Inspector General.
Okay.
At 800-366-4484. And they also advise that you should contact the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and use their FTC complaint assistant at ftc.gov and add the words IRS telephone scam to your comments in the complaint.
Okay, now there's one more thing I wanted to go over, Patty. Don't laugh. This is important. When you send your taxes in, explain to us in snail mail what we should do. Should we have it registered, certified receipt? Should we just dump it in the mail? I want to make sure when we mail it that we have the proper proof that we sent it off.
Right. You can always have a certified receipt. You don't necessarily need to send the green card, which is the card that they stamp it and send it back, unless that makes you feel more comfortable. But you do need proof of mailing. The filing date of April 15th, for example, if you mail your return on April 15th, it is considered timely filed. It doesn't have to be in their hands on April 15th. But if you're going to wait until April 15th to mail it, I would definitely get a receipt.
Right. Right. Well, I live in an area where we're constantly having things disappear in the mail. So I just think you can't be too careful in terms of having the proof and having copies and keeping copies. So don't mail off your only copy.
That's right. Make sure that you keep a copy.
You
so
keep
that you
know
a copy. What
you filed. And you have good receipts. Okay, well, Patty, this has been very, very useful. Is there anything else in summary you'd like to add before we close?
Well, as you mentioned, it's probably a good idea to not try this at home. Do try to find a competent CPA to handle preparation of your taxes. The best way to find someone is to get a referral from a friend or relative that has used someone that they trust. If you don't have the opportunity to get a referral because you don't have friends or relatives using a CPA, you can always contact the state society of CPAs and get referrals from them. But definitely the complexity is great. Lots and lots of tax law changes. Do try to get someone to prepare your returns that knows what they're doing.
Right. Right. I couldn't agree more. Well, Patty, it's been a pleasure to have you on the Solari Report. We know you're going to have a busy between now. When is it? Between now and May is a very busy time.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. So thank you for joining us on the Solari Report. Have a wonderful day.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. You have a great day, too. Thank you.